So I wanted to say something about intention. Or maybe another way to say it is the context in which we practice. So like we come here tonight and we sit on our cushion and we do our meditation. And we may at home have our daily practice, sitting on the cushion or sitting somewhere, and what we do during the day. But traditionally in Buddhism, the context and the intention that is behind these practices that we do is extremely important, and it really informs our development. And just to be very simplistic about it, there are kind of these two major thrusts of intention in Buddhism, and I think in a certain way encapsulates most religious or spiritual aspirations in a certain way. In Buddhism, it's often characterized as the Hinayana and the Mahayana. Maybe many of you have heard these terms, or read about these terms or whatever, Hinayana, Mahayana. And by the way, Hinayana Mahayana is a framework that is talked about in the Mahayana. There's actually no such tradition as Hinayana, but I'll explain in a minute what these mean. So very simply, these are words, Sanskrit words. Hinayana means small vehicle. Mahayana means great vehicle. And it really refers to a vehicle, which in the ancient days of India could have been something like chariots or some kind of coaches or something. They're a vehicle. The small vehicle relates to a vehicle that only has, it is a one-person vehicle. It is a small vehicle. Well, Mahayana is considered a great vehicle, which means it is a large vehicle, so it could convey many people. Now, what is this referred to in terms of spiritual practice, our practice, and our intention? When one is practicing at the Hinayana level, and I would say most of us begin our spiritual meditative undertaking at the level of Hinayana, our concern is really about ourself, right? Our stress, our dissatisfaction in life, our suffering, whatever it is. And this is what is motivating us to undertake spiritual practice. And we could say is if the spiritual practice liberates us, frees us, remediates us from our individual suffering, we would be consider our goal has been achieved. And again, even in the Mahayana, this is not like to be disparaged. It's just an understanding of a level of motivation. And that most of us begin at that very personal existential level of our own suffering, our own dissatisfaction, our own unhappiness, and that is what motivates us to undertake a meditative or spiritual discipline. But on that, in that Hinayana vehicle that we are riding in, there's only room for me. And I am only concerned of getting myself. You know, if you think about why we get into a vehicle, because we are going somewhere, right? And so if I'm in a one-person vehicle, I am only concerned with and only going with one person, right? And I want that vehicle to take me from here to there, right? Now, the Mahayana, the great vehicle, is, again, obviously, as I say, these categorizations are developed within the Mahayana tradition, which is a tradition that calls itself, and those who are familiar with Zen, Zen is a Mahayana Buddhist. It is a Mahayana Buddhist tradition. It's a tradition within the Mahayana Buddhist framework. And I won't go into all the countries that practice Mahayana Buddhism and the sutras that are Mahayana and all that. I mean, that's something else. But we're just talking about the level of motivation. In the Mahayana, we take another step, which is, even though my primary original concern may have been just in terms of my own dissatisfaction and suffering, mental stress disorders or whatever that has motivated me, I notice that I am not alone in that suffering. It's a kind of, you understand, my view is a little larger. I am looking around, and I notice a lot of people are suffering. Right? Not only among my friends and families, and neighbors and society and the world, but historically it seems to be a universal condition, various degrees, etc. And I realize to only be concerned, to only care about my own sufferings, in a certain way, is selfish. And it also doesn't take into account that my suffering is often interrelated with the sufferings of others, right? So we only don't suffer from our own internal mechanisms that cause suffering, but we suffer in relationships with people who also are still overwhelmed with their own personal issues, right, that cause them to suffer and therefore cause you to suffer, as well as we look around the world or look around our community, we see many of the social problems that are affected, you know, that affect us deeply, and the those we love are created by human beings that are also totally caught up in delusive self-centeredness and selfishness and short-sightedness and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And again, I could go on and on if you're interested, but so the person who practices the Mahayana, even from the beginning of their practice, when they state their vow or intention to free themselves of their own suffering, they also acknowledge that they want to be able, and they dedicate themselves to alleviating the suffering of everyone. Right? So it is not only a recognition of interconnection, but it really sets forth quite a personal mission, we could say, for one's life, right? Which says, I am in this life not only to alleviate my own suffering and to develop my own inherent capacities to become a truly good human being and develop all those qualities of the heart-mind that involves, but I am doing that not just simply for my own personal happiness, but because if I have all those requisite competencies and capabilities of true humanness, I will therefore have a better capacity and ability to help others. But also that through my own transformation and development, I can also become a model for others, an inspiration for others, a mentor for others of what it means to be human. You know, I can move this world very slowly in a different direction. So, as opposed to the, we could say the Hinayanas, whose ideal is someone who has personally liberated themselves. The Mahayana's ideal is one who has both personally liberated themselves, but also is selflessly devoting themselves to being of service, help to others. Now, I say this because developing this intention for one's life, developing this intention for one's practice, one can begin right from the beginning, right? And one can plant that seed within one's consciousness, and that every day, by recalling, remembering, and restating that intention to oneself, it becomes more and more a, you know, sort of the motivation for what we do. And again, it is different than somebody being a social activist. It is different from somebody working full-time for a nonprofit that does good work. Because of that thing that we talked about first, which is so essential, which is the personal transformation. So this is not just simply about doing good works, about being of help, which is which you find in most religions or humanistic movements. The unique thing about the this Mahayana vision is that it is through one's own transformation, personal transformation. It is through one's own personal awakening. It's through one's own capacity to really uproot all the basics of selfishness and egocentricity within oneself, that one really then truly has the capacity to be of help to others. Not just in a helping way, you know. Again, not to deny a helping way, but that it was funny. I was talking to somebody today, and they were talking about they were involved in some kind of, I won't go into it, some kind of spiritual tradition, and they were working with setting up workshops and bringing in these big name so-and-sos, and just what an ordeal it was. And, you know, the kind of money these people wanted and the kind of demands they were making and, you know, just the dealing with these big egos. Big egos in a spiritual setting. It seems such a disappointment to this person. But again, that is because true spirituality is not about externals. True spirituality is about this inner transformation, truly becoming selfless, you know, less self. And because in the Buddhist tradition, we want to look deeply at the causes of suffering. And certainly while feeding the hungry, helping the sick, protecting people from violence and war and injustice are certainly good, right? But what is the root of those problems, right? What is the root of those problems? You know, why are they in this world? And especially these days, we cannot help but look at the fundamental issue of selfishness. Right? Of selfishness meaning that I do not acknowledge my interconnection with everyone. I do not acknowledge my interconnection with the earth and the sky, and, right? Greed, right? Happiness is about having more and more for myself, intolerance. My views are right, your views are wrong. My views are true, your views are... You know what I'm saying? So when you look at, you know, we see war, we see violence, we see injustice, we see exploitation, but what is the root of this? Now, we can certainly blame systems. People who come from more sociological blame systems. But there are no systems without people. There are human beings involved. These are human beings. Right? And loving, kind, awake human beings do not go around harming other human beings. Are not indifferent to the suffering of other human beings, are they? So, this Mahayana vision, not only does it incorporate this idea of alleviating the suffering of human beings, but it's at its most fundamental level, it says, it is only by the transformation, the uprooting of the individual suffering of people, and their delusions, and their clinging to their selves, that true transformation of the world becomes then possible. I say that coming back to here, because again, wherever you are in your practice, whether you're just starting, whether you've been at it for 5, 10, 15, 20, or 30 years, to bring into your life and to bring onto your meditation cushion that wish, I undertake this practice in order to alleviate my own suffering so I can better be able to be of service to everyone. It's a very simple type of personal statement that one can make when one undertakes anything. And it begins to inform over time that we actually begin to live that way. Which means wherever we find ourselves in life, right? It's not like we all have to go out and become social workers. It certainly would mean that we would not be in careers that overtly do harm to beings, but it means wherever we are, whatever we're doing, in our lives, in our families, in our relationships, in our work, in our service in the community, there is this motivation to be of help, to alleviate the suffering, the sufferings that we see around us. But at the same time, knowing there's a kind of clarity and wisdom of non-self that also needs to be brought into the social arena, right? So we know, let's say, on the larger scale of even such a thing as, you know, like what we see going on in the world where peoples or whatever deal with injustice. Right, tyranny, you know, like we see going very much in the world, we see one way of going about it is a violent, aggressive manner, but we also see in people like Gandhi, in our own country, Martin Luther King, in the civil rights movement, we see a capacity to move even against in very kind of violent and conflictual arenas, to bring forward that ahimsa, you know, nonviolence, do no harm, and that capacity not to turn the other into a caricature of an enemy, right? But to really go about it. With deep respect, even of the person who is harming you, right? The force of truth, the force of love, Martin Luther King called what he did love in action. Right. So again, I only bring up these examples to show us that this motivation, right, that we have in our practice is very important in terms of how we enter the world. And whether, again, no matter where we are in our practice, to view wherever we are in whatever action we're doing, you know, wherever I am, you know, even if my work situation seems to have nothing to do with service in a more formal way, do I treat everybody I encounter with the deepest of respect? Right? Do I treat everybody I encounter with friendship and warmth? Right? Do I look for ability, the capacity to be of help to those that I am encountering, right? To be of help to them and support to them. In that way, we see that that kind of modus operandi of our life can manifest everywhere we are. Not just in a formal setting. Right. Not just when I'm, you know, doing my volunteer work at the soup kitchen. Right? I mean, I can do my volunteer at the soup kitchen in a totally egocentric way. Right? Look how good I am. What a kind, generous, compassionate person I am. Right? To give up my Saturday and to help these poor people. Right? So I can be engaged in something that outwardly appears compassionate, right? And yet it's only making my ego bigger. Right? Interesting how it works. And I can be in a highly conflictual work situation that has nothing to do with social services or anything. And if there's a conflict between various people on my team, am I a peacemaker? Right? Am I somebody who can let go of right and wrong and see the bigger picture? Am I somebody who's willing to see the other side, right? And to see the, you know, why they are thinking the way they're thinking or doing what they're doing. You see what I'm saying? So this, you know, in our families, in our extended families, there may be many opportunities that we are overlooking to be of service. To bring light, to bring love, to be much more supportive and helpful. So again, it's not, you know, oftentimes we hear about, you know, bodhisattvas and, you know, going to liberate all sentient beings and be of help in the world. And it seems quite grandiose, right? And we forget... it's right here. You know, if it is our karma to be Gandhis and Martin Luther King and you know, act on such a large scale, that may be. But for many of us, it doesn't play out that way. Our universes may be much smaller. But the same opportunities are there. Again, if our motivation, if our intention is always present with us. So again, in the Mahayana, The ideal, again, is what's called the Bodhisattva, this enlightened being who has, he or she has liberated themselves from their own suffering, their own ignorance, their own egocentricity. They have fully cultivated the wonderful capacities of the human mind and heart. They've awakened their intelligence. They've awakened their wisdom and understanding. And they've awakened their loving and compassionate hearts, etc. Right? And they are no longer living for themselves. They are living for everyone. Now that's a bodhisattva. And in Buddhism, anyone who has that wish to liberate themselves from their own suffering and to dedicate themselves to alleviating the suffering of others is a bodhisattva. And so there is nothing grandiose for any of us to say, I am walking the path of the bodhisattva. Actually, in Buddhism, in the sutras, bodhisattva is called, the life of bodhisattva is called a career. Interestingly, it's like a full-time job. Most of the time we define our careers rather narrowly, right, in terms of specific profession. I'm a this or I'm a that. And then people change their professions and then they become a that rather than a this. But for a bodhisattva, their profession is their own personal transformation combined with working selflessly and energetically for the well-being of all. Right? And so therefore, wherever they find themselves, whatever their career is, their job is at the time, that is just a more idiomatic manifestation, right, underneath of this, you know, how in the moment or in this time and space, how the bodhisattva is manifesting. Right. So again, I just wanted to share that with you. Because for many of us, we may need a context for our individual practice to see it in a bigger picture, right? In Andrew's reciting of that opening verse, we talk about the Sangha going as a river. Well, what is that river, right? That each of us as individuals are going in. It is that river of which we could say we are droplets. rivulets, I'm not sure what we are. In that river that is seeking this transformation, healing and transformation of the world. Right. And it's not simply a river when we say the Sangha, just simply of us who maybe conceive ourselves as a certain type of spiritual community. But it's really in that broader river of many, many people of all types and faiths and non-faith, etc., that are... that have aroused within themselves And again, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound, don't make it sound like it's too big a deal, right? It happens all the time. The world is full of good people, right? I mean, everywhere you turn, there are people who are turning away from selfishness, who are turning away from a life just focused on me and my, and, you know, getting as much as I can for myself, for my family, you know what I mean? And are really often putting the needs of others ahead of themselves, or at least equal to themselves. And it goes on all the time. To be a bodhisattva, you don't have to know the word. There are probably more people who are bodhisattvas who've never heard the word bodhisattva than there are people who are bodhisattvas who call themselves bodhisattvas. Thank God. But anybody who really is working on themselves in a meaningful way, and anybody who is sincerely trying to be of service and help to their brothers and sisters in this world in many ways, are all bodhisattvas, without calling themselves by that name. Any questions about this whole issue of intention and Hinayana, Mahayana, different vehicles? Yes.
Just occurs to me when you talk about helping and transforming yourself and trying to transform others, how so many of us, and I certainly speak for myself, but maybe for a lot of other people as well, we're trained by trade to solve problems. So we think we're helping by solving a problem for someone. And then if you look at the whole issue of empowerment or trying to help someone else transform, what are you doing to help somebody when you're trying to solve their problem for you? And that's probably very egocentric. It's very much ego-based thought as well, but it just occurs to me that, you know, that could be a practice in itself. It's just that the smallest things we do, the smallest things I do, where I think I'm trying to help someone, to think about what really helps in the situation instead of my tendency to just want to fix it all the time. So,
yeah. Well, again, I mean, I see, unfortunately, because of the nature of the human mind and humanity, anybody who's been involved in fixing problems know it's like putting fingers in the dike. You know, you put it in here, and all of a sudden you look over there, and there's 20 more, and you could get very frustrated. But that's the nature of this world. I mean, until human beings really get it together, which may be never, but let us say, until human beings ever get together, they'll endlessly create problems. And if we're, you know, once you solve this problem, they create a whole other bunch of problems, right? I mean, human history shows us that. Now, it doesn't mean, it's funny, in the bodhisattva literature, it's very clear, you help people where they're at, right? So if someone is starving, you don't give them a track on Buddhism. You give them food, right? If that's what they need. But understand, giving them food is not liberating them. It's feeding them. It's taking care of a very basic suffering. And we could go on and on with a shelter and clothing and medicine and education. And, it was funny, I was saying something the other day, we were somehow got in a conversation about, the 70s and 80s and the whole thing of women's liberation. And I say that in front of many women here. And I remember when it was going on, many friends were involved, I often kept it to myself. But at the same time, deeply understanding from a social point of view, the obvious inequality of men and women and the need of men and women to be to have equal opportunity and rights, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, from my own particular vantage point, peculiar as it is, I thought, So the end result of this is women are now going to enter this madness, this empty life that men have been so involved in all these years. You know what I mean? I mean, what is going to be the end result of this? From a social point of view, obviously, it's an advancement, right? We can certainly say that. But from a deeper point of view is now we're all, now we're equally, equal opportunity for dissatisfaction and neurosis. Again, you might say that's a social advancement. But when you look deeply, you have to say to yourself, right? Or Angie and I are very involved with educational issues and things like that in St. Petersburg, or somewhat involved, very involved maybe. And again, we can certainly say equal educational opportunity, right, is certainly worthy, right? So everybody can what? Join this American madness in getting a piece of the pie, right? Well, for those people who've gotten a piece of the pie, they've already, many of them, begun to realize how empty it is, right? So, I mean, but for somebody who doesn't have a piece of the pie and very much wants a piece of the pie, doesn't mean that they should not be, that we shouldn't support that. You know what I'm saying? That's a social advancement, isn't it? But if we look deeply, we go, where is this going to end up, right? Another consumer of this empty culture. Right. Now, having said this, that doesn't mean you go to people and say, oh, no, you don't want, you know what I'm saying? Am I explaining myself? And so again, I think I'm trying to answer your question, is if one finds oneself involved in social advancements, or in feeding the hungry, or doing any kinds of good works, charitable works, we also have to understand that that the result may be limited. That the result may be, in the short run, a certain kind of happiness when one is overcoming obstacles or getting away from significantly oppressive or difficult situations. But again, if in a certain way you can go, like in America, right? I mean, we're at the end of that, right? I mean, our trajectory as a society is to come from a society of scarcity, right? To a society of abundance in terms of things, in terms of meeting basic needs, right? And yet what? The human happiness quotient certainly has not changed. And one might even make a case that it's gotten worse. Because people, even the basic kinds of things that created community, family, extendedness, sense of place, people no longer have. People are lonelier than ever, with their bigger homes and their many things. Right? Recently, we saw that documentary, Babies. You see, Babies? Interesting. I mean, obviously, from a social point of view, very different lifestyle from, that child being brought up in that that African bush village, and the one being brought up in Tokyo and San Francisco. I mean, like night and day. And yet, if you said the quality of well-being and happiness in that child and mother, what will we say about that? So we need to look deeply at these issues, right? Again, You know, each of us, in the Bodhisattva tradition, if one says, well, I really want to be able to lead the beings out of their self-created suffering, right? That's my goal. Right? To lead them out of their delusion, to lead them out of their self-created pain and dissatisfaction. The problem with that, as opposed to other types of skills and competencies, is that that takes time, doesn't it? That takes years of cultivation, meditation, to develop that capacity. So in the Bodhisattva tradition, to be spending time developing one's meditative capacity, spending time on retreats and things like that, are considered necessary as part of the training. Because the end result is someone who has these personal capabilities, right? Which you cannot get just by, going to school or going to, to learn a skill, to learn a craft. And so therefore, many people think, the world is such a suffering place, there's so much difficulties and trouble, there's so much need. How selfish for me to go off and do a 10-day meditation retreat, right? How selfish of me. Again, the context. If the context of your practice is you're doing all these somewhat self-centered in terms of, that the focus is now on really understanding and transforming myself, one can certainly say that your focus is on yourself. But within the larger context, if that person is saying, no, I'm doing this so I can rid myself of my egocentric delusions that really prevent me from really being capable of helping in a totally selfless way, free of agendas, free of the contamination of egocentricity and egocentric needs, that I'm doing this so I really have a not only an open heart and a compassionate heart, but I really have seen through the delusions of attachment that cause one to be attached to outcome. That I can enter into this this never-ending work of working for the suffering of beings, working to alleviate the sufferings of beings, knowing it may never happen. Most people, if they engage in an activity in which what they want to happen doesn't happen immediately, get bored or frustrated. Because their view is external. Their view is an internal. When the view is internal, the motivation to help is always present, irrespective of whether... you know what I'm saying? So if you're in... if you want to be of help, and you're in it for the long term, the inner transformation is essential. If you don't want to burn out, get discouraged, get frustrated, attachment to outcome. He is long-winded, isn't he? It starts here. Going to make a few introductory comments, and before you know it, an hour has gone by. Forgive me. So any questions before we stop? Questions, comments on what's been shared tonight? Yes. Right.
And then within our own practice, how do we think about our intention within the practice?
Say more. So you're asking me what? So one is not attached to outcome. It's all inwardly focused. And it's the same thing with our practice. Again, we say our meditative practice or whatever. When we use the term labor of love, what does that mean? Something's a labor of love. I enjoy the process. It's a labor of love. My focus is on not how it turns out. This is something I enjoy doing. Right? In the Buddhist tradition, like the six paramitas, which are the six aspects of practice, joyful effort, right? Not effort, joyful effort. It's a labor of love. Right? And so our practice should be this. I talked to somebody not long ago who was in the intensive, and she went through some difficult things in her life, but said she really needed to drop out, because one of the things she had come to realize, this woman has been practicing for many years, she realized that her practice was a burden to her. It was like she approached it like it was a duty. Something she kind of had to do, you know what I mean? And she realized she never had any joy with it. It was always something that she felt obligated to do. She somehow knew it was good to her. She made a commitment to it. But it wasn't there was no happiness in it. The practice should only bring us happiness, but we should be happy that we're doing it. How lucky we are, right, to have found a path, practices, that allow us to calm and quiet our minds to the best of our ability. Right? Teachings and practices which show us a more meaningful, altruistic way of what this life is about. That should make us happy that we have this path. Right? Irrespective of what's going on in it. And that quality of joy is important. Right? And again, they say in this tradition, one should practice like a flower. What does that mean? It means like a rose or something. In other words, a rose doesn't bloom. And a rose doesn't put out its scent for us. We may be disappointed to hear that. It comes from the inside. The inside, the rose is just being a rose, right? It's not about, hey, look at me. Look how beautiful I am. Or come smell me. You know what I mean? Roses will bloom even if no one's around. Right? Roses will put out their beautiful scent even if there's no one around to smell it. That may seem sort of incredible to us. Right? I mean, why be nice if no one notices I'm nice? Right? From the inside, we practice. in terms of, you know, how you're, you know. So the other side of that is, you know, the rose doesn't live for people telling it it's a good rose. Right? You know, each of us should not live because of, you know, how others perceive us. We shouldn't even care about that. We should bloom for ourselves. And, you know, if people notice or don't notice, that's fine. And also, you know, plants, flowers, they bloom in their own time. You don't know what your time is in terms of your own blossoming. Right? All you know is if you don't practice, you won't blossom. That's all you know. But as long as you practice, practice means you do those things that nurture your awakening. As long as you keep doing those practices, and I don't just mean sitting, you know, I mean practices of altruism, practices of selflessness, practices of love, you know, practices of patience, practices of acceptance, you know, all these practices we do, including the practice of sitting meditation and mindfulness and concentration and insight and all that. We just keep doing it. And in time, it facilitates our blossoming. But again, you know, like the rose, we're not here to always be looking around and saying, how am I doing? Anybody noticing? So why don't we end?